And good afternoon from sunny downtown Philadelphia. Hello and welcome to the Live Printing Impressions webinar, M&A 2013, The Rules of Engagement, sponsored by Consolidated Graphics. This is the first of a two-part series called Art of the Deal, Initial Considerations. I'm Eric Kegel, Senior Editor of Printing Impressions Magazine and a host of today's event. The purpose of this webinar is to examine how changing technologies are impacting the landscape for mergers and acquisitions. We'll take a look at the products and vertical markets that today's buyers are seeking, along with those they wish to avoid. Today's presentation will provide a primer that will enable you to start down the path to selling your business. Now, before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions during and at the end of the hour. You can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. Speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. And now to discuss printing industry transactions in 2013, we have the distinct pleasure of bringing you two truly M&A icons, Joe Davis, Chairman and CEO of Houston-based Consolidated Graphics, and Jim Cohen, Executive Vice President of Mergers and Acquisitions for Consolidated Graphics. Gentlemen, on behalf of Printing Impressions, I'd like to thank you for taking time away from your busy schedules to share some of the finer points of printing industry mergers and acquisitions. I'll let you take it away, gentlemen.
Thanks, Eric. This is Jim Cohen speaking. I just want to set the stage for this webinar. The first thing we're going to do is go through a brief background on Consolidated Graphics, not because this is an advertisement for CGX, but more because I think it's important to have some context for the M&A discussion. Obviously, we have a certain way of doing M&A at our company, and I think the more you understand about our business, the better you will be able to appreciate the context of our remarks. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Joe Davis, who's going to go through a few slides on the background of Consolidated Graphics and our business.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay.
First, let's talk a little bit about what the U.S. printing industry is. It's a giant industry, you know, $163 billion industry. Many segments like newspaper, magazine, catalogs, phone books, other. Our focus is on the general offset and digital commercial printing business, which is a $45 billion business in the United States. Within that $45 billion, it's a highly fragmented industry. There are many smaller companies, some ranging certainly up larger companies. We think we represent about 2% of that marketplace. Other public companies may be as much as 3% of that marketplace. Certainly there's some much larger other companies, but public companies, but they're involved in a number of other things other than what I call the general commercial printing business.
Hey, Joe, I'd like to just add one thing there. I think what's interesting when you look at our business and you look at our industry, if you go back to 2000, the PIA says there were 48,000 printing companies in existence as we defined, you know, our industry. And today that number is down to about 25,000. And of the 25,000, there are probably 2,500 that have sales in excess of $10 million a year. So when you look at this statistic here, 95% local independence, the truth is that most of those companies are less than $5 million a year in sales.
Well, talk about our strategy. A little history on the company. I founded a company in 1985 in Houston, Texas, with the acquisition of one company, Western Lithograph. Had 50 employees and doing $5 million revenue. We had two four-color presses, a two-color 40-inch, and a half web. And from that, First thing I did was start to run that company as a CEO. We were able to grow that company and to make other acquisitions, primarily in Houston. By 1994, we had six companies, five in Houston, one in Denver. And we went public in 94. I remember those days because I was personally guaranteeing about $16 million in debt. That'll make you get up early and stay late 7 days a week, trust me. And anyway, we went public and raised some money to pay off all our debt and had a little money left over for acquisitions. We began to buy what I would say were better companies. One of the first companies we bought was Jarvis Press in Dallas, and I think the second company was Frederick Printing in Denver, both of which we own today and both of which I'm pleased to say are very successful companies in their marketplace. So over time, we now have 70 commercial printing companies in 27 states, as well as Prague, where we opened a new company there, started from scratch, and Toronto, we purchased a company, Annan and Bird, a great company, operated by the two Bird sons. Jack Bird was the founder of the company. His two sons run it today in Toronto. And we also opened a facility in Jero, Japan, to service the Asian market. So our belief as a company is that we offer the service and responsiveness of a local printing company. I mean, the presidents run our companies locally. They don't come to me for day-to-day decisions. Somebody wants something done, they tell the customer they can get it done or they can't get it done, but service is a big focus of ours. But with that, we hope that we bring some efficiencies of a national printer. You know, we hope we have a little buying power. We think we buy more, you know, sheet-fed paper than anybody else in the country. So we should save a little money. I'm not sure we do sometimes. But we got to, you know, each local company has access to what I'll say is some corporate support, such as human resources, taxation support, all those kind of things. And we have been able to use some technology where we've gotten some consistent print quality throughout the company. And our customers really like that we can distribute the files and then print near their delivery point. And that is a big, big factor in a lot of our market today because freight and time to delivery are big items to focus on. So as a company today, we have a lot of capabilities. Certainly we have sheet-fed, web, digital, large and grand format. Technology is becoming a much, much larger part of our business. Today in Houston, I happen to be on the third floor of our building. On the second floor is our, we call it TSSG, which stands for Technology Sales and Services Group. It's run by James Hill, one of our former presidents, and they have 105 employees on the second floor, plus two teams in India and some other folks scattered throughout the country. But we have two full-time teams in India who work exclusively for us so that we can give better service to customers, like, you know, when it's night here, it's day there, so we can come in the morning and find out what they've done the prior day.
And we got another slide coming up where we're going to talk about that more specifically. But, for example, one of the things that they do is we've built probably about 500 web-to-print storefronts for our customers. And obviously that's a trend that I expect most independent commercial printers are getting into as well.
Next we're talking about digital presses. But, you know, it's easy to buy a digital press. All you got to do is call up Kodak, HP, or somebody, and they'll have one at your doorstep. But the question is, then what do you do with it? And I've certainly seen some printers have that experience. You know, the technology backing up those digital presses and reducing the human touch it's very, very important to be an efficient digital printer. So today we have, we think and we say we have the largest digital fleet in the world. And I guess some of our vendors back that up. Actually, years ago, I was sitting down with a guy from Kodak at a NAPL convention or something, in annual meeting, whatever they call it, out in Tucson. And the Kodak guy said, I don't know how big we're getting, but we got to be pretty good size in digital printing. And gosh, this was back in probably 08, 09. I think it's 09. He said, well, Joe, we've done the research at Kodak. You're the largest in the world today, which shocked me, actually. Anyway, we got a lot of digital presses. We've developed what we call digital super centers. You know, all of our companies have a digital press. But then we have super centers to handle large, large type customers. And that's where the distribute, then print, saves a lot of time and money. So the files come at one location, and then we distribute them using software throughout the world, actually. Japan, Prague, in the U.S. And from that, they're directed to a particular machine automatically. And that makes a big, big difference when you get to efficiency. So distribute, then print, saves a lot of time and money and time to market, getting the delivery of the product, as well as freight cost. And I mentioned before that these are all fully integrated. Today, digital printing represents 19% of our total revenue. And our total revenue, I don't have the exact number, but it's slightly over $1 billion today.
Just so you know what you're looking at here, these are actually pictures of the at the top there. It's the T300 press that we have in our Denver location. We've also got a T200 in Chicago, Kodak Prosper in Maryland. We've got an Indigo 10,000 in St. Louis. And, of course, we have iGen, Indigos, and Nexpresses in virtually every one of our companies.
And that represents most of the digital kind of technology. We like to brag that we've got expertise in manufacturing a lot of different types of things. Certainly marketing material, direct mail. I mean, we got our Cyril Scott facility in Lancaster, Ohio. I'd never seen anything like it when I bought the company from Mr. McClellan, who was 82 at the time. But you start with a roll of paper on one end and come out with a finished product on the other end and put it into a, you know, mail bag. So that's one of the products we're able to offer throughout all of our companies.
So they can drop 2 million pieces in the mail each day, so pretty significant capabilities.
Photo products, various types of photo products, from greeting cards to thank you notes to photo books, coffee table type books, and that's a growing piece of our business. Collectible cards range from baseball trading cards to hockey trading cards to other types of games.
One notable one is and we print every Pokemon card in the world except in Japan. If anybody's got kids.
For those of you who have youngsters, about 8, 9, 10, I would say.
Yeah.
Pokemon cards are a hot item. Temporary point of sale materials. Packaging is a growing piece of our business, and we have a couple of facilities dedicated solely to packaging, and also banners and signage is another piece of our business and happens to be growing. Talking about our technology solution, Streamline is what we call our suite of web products, web-to-print solutions, excuse me, that streamline print production and management processes to lower the total cost of ownership. So today we have 442 active sites, 400,000 users, and 151,000 products on these sites. And this is a, as I said, a growing piece of our business, and a lot of the 102 people I sit on the second floor of this building are involved in keeping these sites up and running and servicing our customers. And that's one thing I've learned about technology. It's a lot more costly than I would have ever have dreamed of in my earlier days when we had a light table and a camera and a scanner, and that was a pre-press department. Now you got 100 people here in Houston. We got a big data center with servers and other things. It's in a 24-hour-a-day air-conditioned building that has backup power to survive anything except a nuclear attack. It survives hurricanes because if the electricity goes out, they have battery backup, they have generators on top of that, and then they have fuel trucks lined up, contracts with people to bring in fuel in case the generators go out.
And customers are really requiring that kind of redundancy and backup because, you know, when you're dealing with money center banks or casinos or any other client where they've got customer confidentiality issues and other things, you've got to show them, even if you're not SAS 70 certified, you got to show them you've got a certain protocol and certain safeguards in place.
So all the HIPAA, SAS 70, we got all that certification.
We got chief security officer, you know, all those kinds
of
things.
We have a Chief Information Security Officer, who formerly worked for a big hospital system here, Methodist Hospital. And we talk about technology. That's something that our customers are demanding.
All right, we're going to
talk about our leadership development program. We currently have it's something that I'm most proud of in the company. We hire people right out of college. 554 people currently in the program, 161 graduates, and 26 of our 70 presidents come out of that program. So let's talk about what makes a company attractive to us. And I said we have 70 companies. A couple of them we started, you know, greenfield operations. And I'd say we've merged a few. We've done a few tuck-ins. So I would say, Jim, we've probably done 85, 90 kind of acquisitions over our period of time, mm-hmm. most of which you've been here, mm-hmm. All of which I've been here, by the way. So what do we look for a company? We certainly look at, you know, you have to look at the financial performance of a company. There's no question about that. What is that company doing revenue growth-wise, earnings growth? What does this balance sheet look like? I mean, has it been able to have new equipment? Has it got old equipment, new equipment? What kind of leadership does the company have? Does the owner want to stay on, which would always be our preference, or do they want to retire? I mean, we bought Wetzel Brothers in Milwaukee from Arthur Wetzel when he was 95. And I'll tell you what, we got a non-compete agreement from Arthur as well. Mr. McClellan was 82 at Cyril Scott Company in Lancaster, Ohio. Yeah. And they asked me if I was serious about the non-compete. I said I certainly was. But it depends upon the seller's wishes. If somebody wants to retire and move to Florida, mm-hmm. That's their prerogative. I told Jim the other day I'd bought several houses in Florida. Unfortunately, they weren't for me, but they were people that we bought companies from who live in Florida now. Yeah. So we got a lot of good friends that live in Florida.
I would add, though, that while we do have a few outliers like Mr. McClellan and certainly Mr. Wetzel, the vast majority of the people that we buy companies from, the demographic is a younger
right,
person,
right.
Somebody who generally will stay on and work with us and for us for a number of years after that. And so when we do the analysis here, when we look at companies, we're very serious when we say sort of half the analysis is financial, but the other half of it is cultural fit. We really need to make sure that the company is a good cultural fit because we plan to have, obviously, a long relationship with that management team and that owner going forward. And obviously, when you buy a company, a lot of the value that was created in that company was created by the person who's running it, by the owner. And so if the owner exits, you know, were to exit right after we bought the company, it obviously wouldn't be as valuable to us.
So we like to have continuity of management, certainly.
You know, another thing, just looking at this list, Joe, we got customers. Obviously, we look at the customers. You know, you want to make sure there's not a lot of concentration in any one particular customer. I know occasionally you'll see something where someone might have, you know, 30 or 40% of their business in one customer. But
well, I'd say that's not necessarily a positive from a company standpoint, but as part of our company, that 30% might not be such a big deal to us. So we might be willing to invest in that company regardless of what their concentration might be.
That's true. And one of the things we do, you know, when we're doing our due diligence, we're not going to interfere in any way with any kind of customer relationship. And we look at the list and we know through our experience that no customer leaves because of an acquisition by CGX. It's only a better thing for them. You know, they look at us, and we've got the strongest balance sheet in the printing industry. We've got the ability to service them even better than they were serviced before. So it's not something that we have to do. For example, we'll get into this in another slide, but, you know, if you sell to somebody, let's say, who's not a strategic buyer, who's a financial buyer, one of the things they always do in due diligence is they interview your customers, they get in the middle of your business, and often those deals never get completed, and then you've left your customers sort of scratching their heads. So we don't even do that because we know that when we complete a deal, it's only going to be good news for the customers.
And I look at it, this is a very competitive business. There's not a customer that we have that couldn't go somewhere else today. Not a customer that most commercial printers have couldn't go somewhere else. They're coming back to us for some reason. And I say it's because they like the service and product that they're getting from us. So if you have repeat customers and they're paying their bills, you probably have a pretty good relationship with them. I don't think you need to hire some – we don't think we have to hire some survey firm to go out and survey the customers, which I have seen some people want to do. I just don't think that's necessary. So I guess – one of the things I say it a little more simply maybe than Jim does, but I say we look for good companies with good customers and good employees and a good reputation in the marketplace. And if you got those four things, sometimes the financial results, particularly in today's economy, might not be too good. Or maybe you've overspent on, you know, new equipment or whatever. We would still be interested in talking to you or to a company.
That's true. The last couple of years, certainly in the recession, we've had to do a little more PR to let people know that, obviously, you know, in a perfect world, everyone's got upward revenue growth and earnings growth. But obviously, we all know in our industry that hasn't been the case in the last few years. And we've done a number of acquisitions during those years. So, you know, there's certainly a wish list for acquisitions, and then there are certainly other types of deals that also can make sense for us.
I guess I'm pleased to say I think we've saved quite a few companies.
We have. We saved a lot of jobs, too. The only thing I would say is when you look at it, sometimes people think, well, what can I do to make my company attractive? You know, I would say those things are sort of intuitive. You know, we don't want anyone to manufacture, you know, let's say when they decide to sell, they all of a sudden start behaving differently. You know, the best companies, the ones we want to buy, have sort of been doing it right all along. So at this last bullet point here, we say don't manage EBITDA. We'll get into what EBITDA is later, but basically sometimes, very, very rarely, I'd say, in our industry, do you see people trying to do things to make their companies look more attractive for a sale. Generally, the ones that are just doing well in business are the ones that would be attractive from our point of view.
Okay. Critical path to selling.
I'm going to go through this quickly. This is more procedural. I think this is something that a lot of folks are interested in. if they are going to go down the path to selling their company. So I can give you kind of the highlights here in terms of process. So first of all, the way we find good acquisition candidates, well, it's a couple of different ways. Sometimes people pick up the phone and call us. A lot of time, actually most of the time, I'm reaching out to people, whether it's through a direct mail or letter campaign or just picking up the phone. And then occasionally people hire brokers or investment bankers and they contact me or Joe. Once someone's decided to sell, then the process is fairly straightforward, at least from our perspective as one of the potential buyers. The first thing we do is we sign a non-disclosure agreement. That's for the protection of the seller. When you're going to show us, you know, sensitive information, obviously you don't want it shared, and it's also mutual. We might share things with you that are confidential. And then what we ask for is a very simple, short list of basic information. It's mostly, you know, your financial statements, some information about your real estate, some high-level information about your equipment, the age of your presses, that kind of thing. And then we look at that, and Joe and I sit down, and we probably do this several times a day, literally every day of the week. When we look at that information very quickly and we decide it's interesting, we then decide what's the next step. If we're interested, then I'll typically go visit the company and spend a day or two with the owner. And the reason for that is we don't sit, you know, I don't think it's possible to sit back in our office here in Houston and tell somebody what their business is worth without ever actually even seeing the business and also getting to know the owner. Because like I said before, half of the analysis is cultural fit. So you really need to make sure that this is going to be a person who's going to be able to run the company and cross-sell with our 70 other presidents. We have a really good company culture, so we want to make sure people fit in. After the visit, assuming that that is a favorable on both sides, meaning the seller wants to move forward and the buyer, we want to move forward, we enter into a letter of intent. And all a letter of intent is, I'm sure, you know, obviously most people are familiar with what this is, it's about a two-page letter with a two-page term sheet attached to it that sets out at a very high level what are the principal terms of the deal. And the letter of intent is non-binding. And why, people say, well, why is it non-binding? The reason it's non-binding is because at this point in the process, you've done, as a buyer, you've done no due diligence. You haven't verified anything. That being said, we treat them very seriously, and I'd say probably in the history of our company, 99% of the ones we've signed have closed. And when you go through the letter of intent, the reason why you want one is obviously you want to make sure you have the principal terms of the deal agreed before you start hiring lawyers and spending, you know, several weeks doing due diligence. So the kinds of things that are in this letter of intent are, you know, obviously the price and then some very high-level terms that will show up in the documentation. And while you're once you've signed the letter of intent, you begin due diligence. This is a process for us. It's not really the case with most other buyers, but with us, because we only buy printing companies and we are a printing company, we're able to do this in a very streamlined fashion. So we like to say it's a kind of 4 to 8 week process to complete a transaction. While we're doing the due diligence, we're negotiating the documentation at the same time. The other thing that's nice about us, Joe told me when I first joined that my job was easy, because when he started the company, he used to have to spend more time arranging the financing for the acquisition than actually negotiating with the sellers. And that's a luxury that I really do have. Basically, if we decide we want to buy a company, all we have to do is walk down the hall to Treasury and tell them when to wire the money. We don't need any bank's approval. We don't have what's called a financing contingency. A lot of folks read in the paper that, you know, private equity or financial buyers are buying companies. What they do is they don't have what we call a simultaneous sign and close, which I have here. What they'll do is they'll sign the deal up in a purchase agreement, but there'll be one obvious, big, glaring contingency, and that's, well, we'll do all the things we said we're going to do if we can raise the money. And what that involves is not only the buyer doing due diligence, but then the senior lender doing due diligence, maybe a mezzanine lender doing due diligence. And often that's where those deals unravel, because you have three teams of people turning the seller's life upside down. Usually they're, you know, 25-year-old kids out of Deloitte or some accounting firm. They've never looked at a printing company before. We don't do it that way. We do it all internally, and we do it all ourselves.
Jim, If I can interrupt you for a second, the reality of mergers and acquisitions is that deals, you know, can fall apart along the way, obviously. What are some of the more common issues that you see that can prevent a deal from closing?
Well, I mean, to be honest, the main thing when it, for us, you know, when we get down the road, most of the deals, when we get to a letter of intent, they close. The only one I can think of in my tenure, and I've been here 8 years, is a case of a company where we signed a letter of intent, and I always tell sellers, if this deal is going to fall apart, you know it now. I don't, because I haven't done any due diligence. And it really was a case of their financials just not being accurate. I mean, by a very, very
–
it was a couple of $1 million cash flow swing. And so
and it turned out they really didn't have books. They began to estimate what they thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so the deal was there. The seller knew full well kind of what the situation was. This was no surprise to them. Unfortunately, it was a surprise to us because when we sign an LOI, even though it's non-binding, we have every intention of completing the transaction. Other than that, I would say, you know, what can derail a deal? I would say by the time we get to a letter of intent, there's very little that can derail it because I think the sellers have made an emotional and financial decision to move forward with the transaction.
I think it's very key for both the seller and the buyer to be honest with each other. And if they're honest with each other and open, then I think the transaction's got a really good chance of being completed.
Right, right. And again, there are very few things that are uncertain when we sign the LOI, unlike, you know, for example, we don't have to go raise the money. So we get to that point, I think, you know, it's much more likely a deal might not happen earlier in the process where there's a kind of a mutual decision like, oh, we're just not interested. But that's well before you've invested any real time or money in the transaction. So, okay, Eric, I guess the last question here, well, how long should this take? I'd say with us, like I said, it's a 4 to 8 week process, and when it gets longer, on the longer side of that time period, it's only really because that may be how long it takes a seller to pull together the information, or maybe it's, you know, a lawyer who's delaying it somehow. But that's a very, very fast process. If you look at kind of generally M&A transactions across different industries, I would say most transactions take significantly longer than that. It's obviously also easier for a strategic buyer, that's what we are, an industry buyer, to go through this process because we know what we're looking at. You know, we audit our own companies every day of the week. So there's very little that surprises us, and there's very little that we might discover that might cause us to have second thoughts about a transaction, because even if we find something, we know we're pretty certain we can fix it. The last question here is, do we need to hire an investment banker? Sometimes people think, well, what is an investment banker? It could be anything from a real investment banking firm to a business broker who is just a finder, who just basically makes an introduction of a seller to a buyer. I say it's totally up to the seller. We do not have a preference. In some cases, it can help, actually, in the sense that a banker can say to a seller who's never been through potentially. Obviously, a lot of companies we buy where the owners are very sophisticated and they've done a number of M&A transactions themselves over the years. And then on the flip side, there are a number of sellers who have never done an M&A transaction in their lives, and this is the very first one they're doing. In those cases, sometimes it's easier if they do have an advisor, because then when we say this is customary, this is normal, then we have somebody else who's objective telling them, yes, that's true. That being said, you know, there's a fee involved with that. That's an economic decision a seller needs to make. I would say many of the deals we've done have been direct. You know, that's why I do kind of my own direct marketing campaign, because I like to know people directly, and oftentimes there is no need to hire. I mean, a lot of times what the investment banker does, the highest and best use of an advisor is for them to find the buyer. Well, if you already know who the buyer is, you know, do you need to pay that kind of a fee for it? So it's really, you know, and if you have a good lawyer, you know, that advisory perspective that I just mentioned, that can be provided by a good M&A lawyer too. So I would say we're indifferent. It's really a decision the seller needs to make.
I know a lot of printers along the way have asked me how I feel about consultants. Obviously, there are a number of people within the printing industry who market themselves as M&A consultants. You said from your vantage point, you don't have any real strong feeling one way or another. But I guess from the printer's point of view, that's their way of feeling like protected, that they have somebody has their interest at heart here, somebody who's helping steer them in the right direction based on their experience.
I think sometimes it's very, very appropriate to hire an investment banker. I mean, we deal with a lot of really good ones in the printing industry. So I think there are a lot of good people in that who can help certainly printing companies. And I think that's an individual decision they need to make. I mean, you know, hard to talk to a few, see what they think. But there's some good ones in the industry. We certainly dealt with a lot of them.
And I would say it also does help. It can really help and make it more likely that the deal is going to close. You know, because again, if it's the first time a seller's ever done a deal before, there's a lot of handholding that gets done, and it generally you don't want to be, you know, the buyer isn't going to be the one doing that handholding. It's going to be their advisor. So it can be a good thing. Okay, the next point here, I'll let Joe, you want to talk about this point where there's always this question of whether we should tell the employees and at what point.
Well, I think that's somewhat a personal decision on the part of the seller. I mean, I guess from my standpoint, it's very difficult to keep a secret from employees. So I try to be as open as I possibly can with our employees as a public company. Why tell them early? I think that's an individual kind of decision. And is it wrong to lie to my employees? I don't think you should ever lie to your employees. So in the context of a seller, if we enter into a letter of intent with a seller, it can be all confidential up to that point. There's no need to involve a lot of folks. Certainly you probably need a CPA involved or something, maybe a lawyer or a broker or investment banker. But other than that, I don't see a need to have anybody else involved if you're the sole owner of the company. At that point, however, we or any buyer would begin due diligence. They want to come out and verify the books and records of the company. So one thing that I will not do and I won't allow my people to do, they say, well, come in, act like you're an insurance agent. Well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to let my people do that because I don't want them misrepresenting themselves to our future potential employees. And we're just not going to lie about it. I did it one time in my life. I signed in a visitor's log. They told me how to sign in, you know, call myself whatever. It's the last time I've ever done it. I'll never do it again. I violated it one time over in North Carolina. Never do it again. So I don't think it's a very good idea. I don't think you have to tell your employees ahead of time. It's a personal decision. But once you start due diligence and you have outsiders coming into your facility, I think you need to be very candid and open.
And the other
and
thing,
I don't think anything bad is going to happen one way or the other.
For us, I mean, we actually do think it's a very positive message. You know, obviously most employees might prefer the status quo, but if you're going to sell, I think, you know, when we go in, we say, hey, look, this is really good news for the buyer, for the employees, particularly the salespeople and everyone else, and let us tell you the story of why that's the case. If you wait until they kind of inadvertently find out and then you're responding and giving them sort of the message it's good news, they're not going to believe it because they'll say, well, if it was good news, why didn't you tell me in the first place? So there was only one deal I've done here where that's happened, where we did kind of what you're talking about, where we at the very first we had a site visit. They didn't want us to say who anybody was, and literally there are only three of us just walking the floor. And because we have this associate program where we have not only 500 people in it currently, we have a lot of graduates and other folks who work for other competitors. Well, we're just walking the floor, and one of their employees was on the floor and recognized one of the guys with me. And within about 5 minutes, you know, everyone in the company knew. And then that seller was on the defensive about why they didn't just, you know, basically announce it already. And so then they did, and, you know, it just took a little more hand-holding. So it's a sensitive issue, but we've done it, you know, many times, and we think we've got a good approach to it.
Now, Jim, I'm sorry, Jim. With a union shop, are you under? I assume there might be a contractual obligation to let the employees know with a union shop.
I don't believe I've ever had a contractual obligation. That I've seen in the union contract that you had to notify employees. Now, as a courtesy, we would encourage the seller to notify the union at some point. Sort of at the same time he notifies his employees,
well,
slightly
yeah.
ahead of time.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
But there's typically no requirement in a union contract that they be notified. Now, I guess there could be a union contract. You know, union contracts can all be different, but I've never particularly seen that.
Well, one example I remember when you're thinking of a union company was when we acquired the Hennigan Company. I went out there to help make the announcement to the management team, which then disseminated the news to their employee base when we signed the letter of intent. And they had an in-house lawyer or an administrative person who was on the locals pension board or something, and he went at that same time and told them. And yep. The news that we got back was they were very excited about it. So it was good. I think they appreciated that we told them. You know, the LOI is a non-binding document, but at the same time, that's about as early as you're going to tell anybody, and I think they appreciated that we had done that.
And we have about 20% of our companies that are employees are covered by a labor contract.
Okay, let's. I'll take this next slide just to briefly go through the types of buyers. I think we've already used some of these terms. It's just terminology for better or worse. It's a fancy way of saying, you know, you're a printer. Is, you know, when you talk about strategic buyers, it means somebody within the industry. So it's not an investor group. It's not a private equity fund. It's a one of your competitors, basically, or just somebody in your same line of business. A financial buyer is what we call a private equity fund is a financial buyer. It's an investor group generally. And then you get into all these other questions, you know, is one better than the other? You know, it totally depends. I mean, what you're looking for. You know, some folks, if all they want out of a deal is, let's say, cash, and, you know, there's a debate. I mean, clearly the public view is that strategic buyers generally pay more than financial buyers. Well, why is that? And people say, well, the reason is that if you're an industry buyer, you can afford to pay more because you'll have what's called synergies. You know, if you know the business and you've got areas where you overlap and you get more scale, there might be some value there. But it's not always the case. And these financial buyers, one of the things I've got here as you go down is there are risks associated with selling to these kinds of folks. We don't need to get into this debate now, but you know, one thing is for sure, when you sell to us, at least let's say you sell to us, it's a permanent investment. You know, we're going to hold that company. We buy 100%. The owner cashes out, and hopefully the owner stays on and runs the company. But we're not looking to flip that company to make a return for our shareholders. The way we bring a return to our shareholders is we earn money through that company. Conversely, a financial buyer, what they do is the minute they buy it, which, by the way, typically they'll leverage it up with as much debt as they can because they want to put in as little equity as they can get away with. Basically, they buy the company and then it's for sale the next day because I see these announcements all the time and I call these funds all the time. Typically, they'll hold the company for 3 to 5 years and then flip it. So it's just a different scenario. It depends what you want with your employees. For your employees, it's a little, I would say, a little less stable, certainly. And then, of course, there's some risks of execution in terms of they have to raise the financing to get these deals done.
The one thing I would caution any owners about is this. There's always somebody who has a briefcase and a cell phone and calls themselves somebody buying companies. And they tie a company up and then get a definitive agreement, and then they take that document out to see if they can raise the money. They have absolutely no equity to put in it. They take the document out to see if they can raise the money. And I've unfortunately seen a few people have been strung out for 6 or 8 months on some story like that.
And even with reputable funds, it's happened where they have to get their lenders involved and it just takes longer. And then you got a lot of smart people trying to show that they're smarter than the other group and they, quote, discover things and due diligence and then go back and renegotiate the terms. So I think you need to be careful. Also with strategics, though, you need to be careful whether you're doing a tuck-in or vice versa. You need to look at the balance sheet of the person who you're talking to, and I would suggest you do that at the very earliest stage. It's not something that, you know, comes to mind intuitively, but that's one of the silver linings of being a public company. I can show our balance sheet to anybody anytime. It's online, and it's obviously a big selling point for us, not just with sellers, but also with customers.
Okay, changing technologies. Certainly, that has an impact on the printing industry and the M&A activity in the industry today. I mean, if I never say we wouldn't want to look at any company, but certainly a company that just has offset printing today, or only web printing, or only this, or only that, probably wouldn't quite be as attractive to you today from a buyer standpoint. You know, certainly digital is a growing area. Or do old presses kill a transaction? Well, I'll have to say this. The most expensive piece of equipment in a printing company is normally a press. So if you buy a company, you pay the seller, and the next month you got to buy a new six-color, 40-inch six-color with a coder, and UV, and spend another, you know, $3 million, that's going to be a pretty expensive acquisition. And how are you going to pay for it? So old presses and the lack of CapEx in a company historically is certainly a impacts the valuation of a company. I'm not saying they can't be bought or sold. I just say it impacts the valuation. Will anyone buy a union printer? Well, we certainly bought some union printers, and the pension issues, the labor contracts, are all kind of an individual thing. You just have to look at them and get some lawyers involved and hope you know what you're doing when it's over. How do we look at an acquisition? Certainly, I go back to we look for good companies with good people with good reputations. And certainly, you know, if it's got a strong balance sheet, that's a big plus. And, you know, what is EBITDA and why is it so often used as a metric? Well, I think a lot of people talk about EBITDA. I think we look at a lot more than EBITDA when we look at a company. That's just one element of evaluation of a company. Where is that company going? Jim has a model here that we look at, a financial model. But I think the personal piece of companies are more important than the financial model, quite frankly. Is it going to be a culture fit? Are the people going to be able to grow that company? What's going to happen to that company 1, 2, 5, 10 years from now? And is goodwill a good or bad thing? That's a bookkeeping number. I think goodwill is an important thing. Goodwill meaning, do your customers like you? Do you have a good reputation in the industry? When you put goodwill on your books, that's sort of a bookkeeping idea. To be good or bad, I don't know. I think how you stand in the business community is much better than any of the bookkeeping stuff.
Okay, I think, Eric, did you want to turn to questions now? Is that where we are in the timing of this?
Yeah, I think we can go over a few questions. We have time for that. We have one listener who wants to know, how do you place a value on a tuck-in?
Well, I think I can answer that. I don't know if there's any particular way to place a value. You just have to look at the facts and circumstances. And we you know, tuck-in's a fancy term, but for various reasons, a company might not be able to stand on its own. Maybe at the end of a lease or for whatever reason. I think it just takes a lot of judgment, and you have to figure out how to value it, and sometimes that's difficult.
Yeah, there's no.
So I don't know if I could give you any. There's not a rule of thumb in valuing printing companies, unfortunately. If it was that easy, I wouldn't have a job.
Well, also, particularly on the tuck-ins, it's kind of a strategic decision at each wherever you're looking at, whatever market you happen to be in. You know, what's it going to do with the company you're looking to tuck it into? I think what we see in the marketplace, not our kinds of deals, but you know, you do read about a lot of either tuck-ins or quote mergers, and it's very difficult to discern from reading in the press what the motivation was for a deal, what the value was. You just can't tell. None of that information is public. Okay, Eric, you got another one?
Yeah, the questions are really starting to roll in now.
See,
What's the minimum annual revenue before you'll even consider an acquisition?
Well, I don't know that we like to have a particular minimum. I mean, I think that depends on a lot of factors. What kind of products a company has, what its growth potential is, and so forth. I mean, if it was a sheet-fed printer with $2 million revenue that was going to be a standalone company, that probably wouldn't fit us today, although we've certainly, you know, acquired some of those in the past. But if it was a digital company that had a great product and knew how to do something we didn't know how to do, added a lot to our mix of offerings, we'd probably be interested in that.
What's nice about us, too, is, I mean, literally, this is my full-time job, so there's really no harm in us looking at almost anything. You know, we can tell somebody, you know, if it's too small, we'll tell them in the first conversation. But if you know, there might be something unique about it, and it warrants taking a look. So, there are some benchmarks we use, but particularly now, given the technology costs for each company, whether it's pre-press or otherwise, but it's really an ad hoc kind of decision, case-by-case basis.
And that's one thing. It doesn't cost much to find, you know, somebody wants to talk to us. And the good thing about us is the only people here who know anything about what's going on acquisition-wise is Jim and I. And we don't share it with any of the other people here in the office.
Yeah, that actually reminds me, Eric, there was one thing we didn't necessarily cover, but in the non-disclosure agreement, it is something that I'm sure everybody's sensitive to. It's a lot different when you're dealing with a potential buyer down the street in your own market than when you're dealing with a larger company like us. For example, when we were reviewing a transaction, we might, let's say there's a company in the Baltimore, D.C. area. You know, we have a number of companies there, but none of those folks will even have any idea that we're looking at somebody in that market. It's just Joe and me. And you know, conversely, if you're looking to sell to someone down the street, the guy who's coming to do the due diligence is probably also the guy who is selling against you on a daily basis. And so it's not to say you can't pursue those kinds of deals. It's just you have a whole different set of concerns, and you probably want to tread a little more carefully in those circumstances.
What is the range of EBITDA to value that you have seen recently?
Well, like I say, you look at public companies from an EBITDA standpoint, and we don't look at EBITDA necessarily on a private company. But if you look at the public company market, you'll find today that the Donnelley, R. Donnelley, what are they, $11 billion company or something, Quad, which is a, I don't know, huh? $4-5 billion revenue company, us, and we're all trading at about 4x EBITDA. Those earnings before interest, taxes, and depreciation on a 12-month trailing basis, about 4x. So one of the problems facing the public companies is the world thinks, or the financial community thinks, that printing is declining. Well, in our particular case, our revenue has been about flat since the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. And, you know, our revenue, we produce a lot of items. Now, certainly certain segments of ours are growing, certain aren't growing. I mean, annual report business used to be big, big business for us in, you know, February, March, April of every year. That business today is almost gone. But we have a lot of pieces of our business that are growing. Some segments, we isolate some growth segments representing about 40% of our business, are growing at 9% compounded annually in the last 5 years. So, you know, depending on what kind of business you're in, some are growing, some not growing.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, Eric, I was just going to say, not that we really use this metric, but, you know, oftentimes when you look at a public company, it's trading, let's say, at 4x. If you were to look at an exact replica of that same company that were private, generally it's considered that the public company should be valued at a premium of maybe 20, 25% to the private company because you have immediate liquidity, meaning you can sell a share online in about a minute. as opposed to having to go through a long process and, you know, try and sell something that's relatively illiquid. But that's also a reason why we don't really look at that, because obviously it's going to be difficult to value companies if that's all you're looking at.
We have a listener who wants to know if CGX is interested in having a Northeast presence.
Well, we have some Northeast presence today. We'd probably like to have more Northeast presence.
Yeah, I think that's what they were aiming at.
Yeah, I would say that.
We got nothing against it. The thing that people sometimes people think that our strategy is based on geography. It really isn't. That's a consideration, but it's not the primary driver. The way that our map sort of came about, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, but we look for the best companies that make the most sense, that are the best fit, and over 28 years, we've got a footprint that is pretty impressive and spans the whole country. But there are certain cities where we certainly would objectively like to maybe have more of a presence, but we got to find the right company. So we'd like more good companies everywhere.
Someone would like to know which method of initial contact do you prefer, letter to management, email, cold call? What's the best way to approach?
Well, I'll answer that, because if you go to our website, there's actually an M&A section with some articles that I would encourage people to read, and there's also a link to my email. So I would say certainly an email.
Telephone call.
Or a telephone call, either one. We welcome that. I mean, even though we're a large company, we operate like a small company. I answer my own phone. So if somebody calls me, I'll pick it up. If he called Joe, he'll pick it up.
We have a specialized printer here, a narrow web roll-to-roll offset and digital printer that caters to the wine and distilled spirits industry. Is this a niche industry that is attractive to a buyer?
Are they doing wine labels? Is that what that's for, I assume?
And so
I don't know what kind of technology they're using. It's offset, I guess. There's also digital now. There's waterless ink
Flexo.
And all. Yeah, Flexo. I would say I can't speak, for the industry at large. We certainly I've looked at some of those companies before. We don't have one that only does that, but we would have an interest in looking at that, for example.
But we're certainly in the label business.
Yeah. Yeah, we are. I was thinking more just wine labels, but certainly we have a lot of label business. And that's generally what you find with us, is that we have a lot of companies that have different – they're all offset printers and digital printers, but many of them have specialized niches. For example, if you look at us, people don't think of us as a packaging company, but when you look in the aggregate, we probably do about $100 million in revenue just through packaging. But we don't have any company that is 100% only packaging.
Yeah,
so
one location.
One location.
Not a company, a piece of a company.
A piece of a company, right. Yeah, that's true. So same thing, we got companies that do Flexo, and we have companies that do labels. So it's definitely something we would look at.
I think we have time for one more question. Somebody wants to know, and I think this is a very good question. I know the answer, though, but how much cross-selling actually takes place after a company is acquired by CGX?
Well, actually, I'm glad somebody asked it. There's quite a lot of cross-selling. Let's take a company who has only sheet-fed printing, and we got a number of those. They now have access to web printing, grand format printing, direct mail, inline finishing equipment, and a number of other things. So our total revenue, about 15% of our total revenue, I think it's the right percentage.
A little less.
14%, 14 yeah. point something percent of our total revenue relates from a salesperson sitting in Houston who's selling a production at a web shop in, say, North Carolina, that kind of thing, or selling a direct mail program that's produced in Lancaster, Ohio, or a digital job that's produced in St. Louis or Chicago.
Or maybe it's an international job that's printing
and
delivering abroad.
Right. Or maybe something that's we're working with a company in Chicago who's printing something in Prague for delivery to the European market. Or in Japan.
All righty. I think that's going to just about do it. We're out of time for today. On behalf of Printing Impressions and Consolidated Graphics, I want to thank you for attending today's webinar. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all our archived and upcoming webinars. And also, please, if you would just take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen next, we would be grateful. Your feedback will influence the webinars we bring to you in the future. And of course, don't forget to register for part two of our M&A series, The Path to Completion, scheduled for June 11th. Thank you, and have a good day.